All right, well, turn in your sheets, if you will, little purple sheets. I'm going to introduce the prophecy of Obadiah tonight. Remember last week, I gave sort of an overview of the prophets. The prophet's role, if you were to picture the prophets and a priest in your head, what would be the difference in stance for a prophet versus a priest? If God is here and the people are here, then the priest does what? He faces God and speaks for the people. As a general statement, the prophet faces the people and speaks for God. Although they do both sometimes. Moses definitely was serving in almost a dual role, but never called a priest. But he spoke with God a lot. The prophets listened to God a lot and occasionally would record their dialogues like Habakkuk did. But the prophets speak to people for God. They say, this is what God is saying. No one has heard this statement directly before. And then they speak what God is saying. Okay. Sometimes they will refer to something spoken before, but they are speaking revelation that God gave them. The priests, on the other hand, generally are helping people remember what God said, and they are helping interpret what God has said. So they have distinctive roles. Obadiah is one of those prophets, and a lot of what we'll talk about tonight is, when did Obadiah prophesy? You say, well, is that a question? Sure it is. In fact, as I was preparing, I was amused that one of my instructors, the notes that I'd taken back in, goodness sakes, probably 1987 or 1990, had preferred a late date, a 586 date for Obadiah's prophecy. But in the study notes that he wrote for a study Bible that I treasure, he preferred the early date. So, we're permitted, there's room here for some discussion. But I'd like to just give just an overview of Obadiah, and then we will read the letter as well. Just as a reminder, on the back of last week, I gave almost 40 different prophets' names, right? But not all of these are in print kind of prophets. Many of these are prophets who spoke short times, or very little was said about what God spoke through them. And the order on this is not exactly the order that I will use as we go through it. So this is somebody's order, and I've adapted it somewhat more for my own convictions on things here. If you didn't get one of those and you want one, ask me. I'll get one for you. Don't worry. Looks like Darlene's nodding her head. Yes, she'd like one. So we'll send that. Can you send that? Just send that back to her. Thanks. Okay. Turn to Obadiah, and I'd like us to read through it once, and then we'll introduce this amazing, amazing letter. And I'm going to ask us to sort of break it up into three different portions. So Sunday school class, likewise, I'm going to invite three different people to read first the verses 1 through 9. Someone who'd like to just read those clearly and loudly for us. Obadiah 1 through 9. Al, please.
Destroy the wise of Edom, people of understanding in the mountains of Edom.
Thank you. Okay, those are the first nine verses, and God is addressing Edom. I'm not going to explain it just yet. I just want you to hear it and be thinking about it as we continue. Verses 10 through 16. Another reader, please. Harry, thank you. Thank you. Wow. Weighty. Weighty. And then the conclusion to this prophecy, 17 through 21. One more reader, please. Thank you, Jim.
But on Mount Zion there shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness. The house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. The house of Esau shall be stubble. They shall kindle them and devour them.
Nice to have some resolution at the end, isn't it? It's encouraging. So just popcorn response. What are you seeing this prophecy is about? Anything you saw? Okay, it goes back to the feud, the conflict between Jacob and Esau. Somehow I was hoping that was settled when Jacob said, you know what, you stay here, I'm going to move on. But we humans aren't like that. We don't forget offenses, even to our ancestors. Ron?
Also, there's a theme of the bridge and the day of the Lord. Ooh. It's used several times.
Okay. Thank you. Now, the theme of the day of the Lord, that is going to come up dozens of times as we go through the prophets. And the day of the Lord, the main point of that is it's His day to settle the score. Whether that's one short time, because sometimes the day of the Lord refers to a specific judgment, or whether it's a long time of judgment, such as the tribulation, or whether it's including the millennium, because sometimes the day of the Lord is described to refer to a time of blessing. Sometimes as big as that, and other times it's used to refer to a short time of blessing. The point is, He's the Lord over all time. And when He says the day of the Lord is going to come, that means He's going to take action at a certain point in time. And so that's a very important theme. Anything else you notice you want to highlight before we move through it? Okay. There's a lot to observe in this prophecy. And I hope you will be patient with me as I go somewhat step by step, stone by stone, rather than zoop across the brook. We're just going to go across one big rock and look around, and then next week we'll go to another big rock and look around. The big picture, if I were to name a theme for this, I've entitled it Judgment on Edom's Arrogant Enmity. You have to be careful how you say it, but Edom's arrogant enmity. They were hostile towards the people of God. And the question is, when were they hostile? And we're going to talk about that. If you could divide it into a two-part outline, the destruction of Edom in 1 through 18, and other nations are included as we finish those 18 verses, and the deliverance of Israel, short-term and then very long-term as well. Now, why is this important? Well, or why is, what is going on here? We're going to talk about the date. We are going to talk about the date. But, and we're also going to talk about the history between Jacob and Esau as well a little bit. But just to note, there has been continual conflict between Jacob and Esau, right? If we were to sort of summarize it, pull my paper here. And I'm not seeing it right in front, so that's okay. What do you remember about the relationship between Jacob and Esau? I do have it here. Were these guys strangers who met out in the middle of the desert or something?
It started at birth.
Even before birth. Yeah, Darlene's point, even before. Sure, that's right. And he was nicknamed, he was called Jacob, which can mean grabber or grappler. It can also mean deceiver. Okay, yeah, very, very unusual. I mean, this is Rebecca the mama, right? Yep, Jacob and Esau. Right, this is Rebecca. What a pregnancy! And she says two nations are wrestling inside my tummy. She didn't just mean heads of future nations, but she probably felt like there's a whole two nations wrestling each other even before they were born. Very unusual. When they were born, one was named Esau, and later his nickname was called Edom. What did Edom mean? Red. Yeah. Because he was born and appeared to have red hair, or maybe even some red skin, but he was hairy and red, and as he grew up, he was considered red, sort of a reddish hue. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He made a red stew as well. And maybe it's sort of like, this is my trademark. Sort of like as if Steve Jobs, who always had a black shirt and amazingly comfortable looking blue jeans. You know, Esau, red stuff is his trademark. There's also something unique about the land of Edom. The land itself had reddish kind of soil. Now, I don't think that's because of the name. I just think people notice that, okay? When they see it's red, they say, oh, yeah, Edom's also very red, just like this father, the ancestor, the patriarch was. And so they have a lot of interesting history between Jacob and Esau. Esau did not really honor his parents. He married whomever he felt like, regardless of their direction. He married, quote, to make them happy, but he didn't consult them. That's a pretty bad pattern, right? I'm going to try to make somebody happy, but I never consult them. Learning how to listen to authority is really a good thing. And he didn't learn it. He considered his inheritance nothing because he said, you know, if I die of hunger, what good is my inheritance? Yeah, I'll trade my inheritance to you, Jacob, for that stew, that red stew you made for me. Okay. So on a human level, he was considered to have given up his birthright. On a divine level, it took God to do that. But God had spoken and said, I'm going to favor Jacob, Rebecca. You need to know that. So very interesting how that worked out. When Jacob's descendants later came out of Egypt, then this is why I put the map in, just to locate here where we are. And y'all are pretty sharp, so you don't really have to have a map of the ancient Near East. But you can see it. And you can see on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea, That's where the land of Israel is. And, of course, straight south where you have all these rivers flowing, that's Egypt. And as Israelites came out across the Negev, they came up and the route is debated, but they could have come up this way. And the most popular conclusion is they came up toward Edom, were rejected, went down and had to go around the eastern side of Edom. And so I stuck that map in there for your pondering and noticing. They wanted to travel the King's Highway, but it ran through Edom. Why would the Edomites perhaps reject the Israelites coming through? It's more than blood. It's part of it. What else? The fear word, right? They're afraid. These people are a lot of people. They could really mess up our land. So what if they claim they're related to our ancestor, Esau? So what? We're not going to let them in. After all, who knows what the nations above us are going to do to us if we let them in? And so they were afraid, and we read about that in Numbers. So they did not let them through. So that's a little bit of a mini history of Edom, the Edomites. They did settle right there in that southeast, that portion southeast of the Dead Sea. And north and east of the Red Sea, or just straight north of the Red Sea. And that's the way, by the way, I remember the little names. You have the Big Sea, that's the Med. You have the Little Sea, which is the Dead. And then you have the big one over here, which is the Red. So you got the Med, Dead, and the Red. And if you got that, you got it in a nutshell like I do. But we'll leave that alone. So the prophets, I listed them in an order that we would believe good conservative people would say this is probably the order at which they spoke and finished their writings. And there's a nice little map that has a number of these prophets pinpointed in a map on there for you. You're welcome to refer to this, you know, week by week or not at all. But I thought that was handy for me. Maybe it'll be handy for you as well. So what is the issue here? We have some issues with the date. And I'd like to walk through a summary of how to deal with the date. You might flip your page over. The date is considered to be around 840 BC or 586 BC. Those are widely different dates. Why would those be so different? Look at letter Z, the time frame, the setting for this letter. Some would say, I'm going to go with the later date. Later date means it has a smaller number, right? Are you okay with that? Okay. If we believe creation could have been about 4,000 BC, that's the bigger number. Smaller number is right at Christ. So BC, you have 1 BC, you have 1 AD in the middle is 0, if you want to call it a 0. But that is roughly then. So BC, the smaller the number means a later date. A later date of 605 to 586, that would be during Babylon's invasion of Jerusalem. If that were the date, the background for Obadiah's writing, that would make Jeremiah a contemporary of Obadiah. Why would anyone think that? Well, we're going to do a little exercise. This is something that people way more intelligent than me, way better study than I do, would do and put it in print, but I thought it was sort of eye-opening for us. So I'm looking for two people who will read in response to each other, one from Obadiah, one from Joel, some portions from Joel 3, and then Joel 1, and then 3 again. So a couple people would like to do call and answer, maybe someone that hasn't read yet. Okay, Darlene, how about if you do Obadiah and just follow along those beginning Obadiah 10, you read one, and then Karen's going to pipe up from the back in her school teacher voice from Joel chapter 3, and then a couple times chapter 1, 2, and 3. And just there's some comparisons, some significant parallels between these two prophets. All right, you ready for Obadiah 10? Okay, do it one verse at a time, please. Okay, 11.
And the ladies that are, while strangers carried off as well, and foreigners
Okay, go ahead and put Joel 1:15 and 2:1 and 3:14, please. Okay, thank you. Eight and nine, yeah. 1F usually means the next verse. I should have said 8 to 9. Interesting, isn't it? These guys use some of the same words, some of the same phrases. They're describing things in the same way. Very interesting. So some would say, wow, Joel and Obadiah must have been about the same time. Well, then the question is, does Joel tell us when he prophesied? And again, good evangelical men, some will say 586 B.C., some will say 850 B.C. Between Obadiah 1 through 9, and Jeremiah 49:7-22, there's some significant parallels. Let's read through those again, too. There's really no harm in getting the text imprinted in our memories. there's great value in that. So someone who'd like to do the Obadiah part and someone else to do the Jeremiah part. Obadiah? Okay, it's okay if you read once. Okay, please do. Okay. All right, someone to read from Jeremiah 49. Thank you, Alice. Okay. Let's start with Obadiah 1 and just listen. You say, why are we doing this? I'm doing this because most of you teach Sunday school at some point or another. Okay? Or you're involved in discipling somebody. And so this is something you do sometimes when you're trying to figure out what's going on here. So Obadiah 1 and Jeremiah 49. Let's start with Obadiah 1, Rose. Just verse 1. Thank you.
I heard a message from the Lord, and an envoy is sent among the nations, saying, gather yourselves together and come against her and rise up for battle.
Thank you. Wow, a messenger's coming for battle. All right, Obadiah 2.
The pride of your heart has deceived you. You will live in a corruptible rock. Okay. And for the terror of you, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. For you who live in the cleft of the rock,
okay,
you occupy the height of the hill. Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars,
Oh, go ahead and read the whole verse then. Yes, ma'am. Great. Thank you. Remarkably similar, are they not? Sometimes they are direct quotes, although with their English translations, you may hear a little variation there. Remarkable. So either they're describing the same event, or they're one's borrowing from the other, or we can simply say, which we know is true, God overruled and spoke the same thing through both men. So are they describing the same event or different events? Some would say Obadiah presents the fall of Jerusalem as a past event and the fall of Edom as a future event. So a probable date would be after 586 when Jerusalem was destroyed by Babylon, but before 553 BC when Babylon campaigned against Edom. The most likely situation in this view is the first half of the Babylonian exile, and it would have been written from Jerusalem. So I'm giving you some of the support for that. Here's some further support for that. There's support simply for the fact that Jerusalem did fall at Nebuchadnezzar's hand. This is a photocopy of a photocopy, so please don't try to read it. I can't read Akkadian myself anyway. But this is a translation of an ostraca, or an old tablet, actually in this case, a tablet. And it says this: in the seventh year, the month Kislemu, the king of Akkad, called up his army, marched against Syria, encamped against the land of Judah, and seized the town on the second day of the month Adar. He captured the king. He appointed there a king of his own choice. He took much booty from it and sent it to Babylon. It's widely agreed that this is from the seventh year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. It would match the biblical record. So this is just, by the way, there's extra biblical history that supports when Jerusalem was invaded. That's not a question that decides when Obadiah spoke, but it's an interesting thing. You say, how did all this take place? Well, I'd like to read a little summary, a couple pages of summary of what was going on before invasion of Jerusalem in 586 and what and how it came to pass. The little document I read is called Arad 24. Arad 24 was written and dispatched at the swell of Babylonian subjugation when Babylon was coming to power. Nebuchadnezzar had defeated the Egyptians at Carchemish, which is in what country? Egypt, right? Down here, 605 BC, they beat the Egyptians. And they were systematically pushing their way south. By the following year, Babylon had claimed nearly all of what's called the Levant, which means from Syria down towards Egypt. Many of the cities had been destroyed and all their inhabitants deported. The response of the king of Judah is seen in 2 Kings 24, verse 1. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim, listen to this, became his servant, or Eved, for 3 years. No. Any issues with that? If you are a Hebrew king who knows the living God who spoke to Abraham and Moses, you know you are never to make treaties with nations that put you under their subjugation. So Jehoiakim, instead of fighting, became an Eved, or a servant, for 3 years. By the way, that would make him an Eved Nebuchadnezzar, a servant of Nebuchadnezzar. Who wrote this prophecy? What's his name? Obadiah. His name means servant of Yahweh. Okay. Obadiah's name is not by accident, whether it was given as a hallmark name to say, this man is a servant of Yahweh, or whether God sovereignly through his parents gave him that name, and then when he prophesied, it fit right into saying, you need to be a servant of Yahweh, not a servant of these godless, powerful people. But Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, became his Eved for 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. Okay. It's sort of like trying to teach a teenager that doesn't get it, right? You know, first, you serve someone you're not supposed to. Then you rebel against that. What do you think is going to happen? Now you have the living God angry and you have the human power. It's just foolish. For one king to become the Eved of another was to assume the status of what we call a vassal, which means a servant leader, a servant under a foreign power. And in most cases, you had to pay tribute to the foreign power or the suzerain. So you have the suzerain who's in charge, the vassal is the servant. Jehoiakim consented to this relationship for 3 years and then decided to break it off for some reason. Such an act would mean immediate retribution from the suzerain or from other vassals the suzerain controls. This perhaps explains what happens in 2 Kings 24, the next verse, verse 2a. And the Lord sent against him bands of Chaldeans, bands of Arameans, bands of Moabites, and bands of Ammonites. Wow. Judgment came. Probably Nebuchadnezzar sent those vassal allies against Jehoiakim, but God was over all of that happening. This moment of vulnerability would have been the opportune time for Edom to carry out further raids. Kick the king while he's down. No doubt Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, had received word that the force of Nebuchadnezzar's armies had been weakened because of a recent battle with Egypt. He probably thought he had the opportunity to be free from Babylonian intervention and to withhold the annual tribute. So as a result, Nebuchadnezzar enlisted Judah's neighbor's help and sent them with his own troops. Edom was one nation that was there. Their aim was no doubt to keep Judah alive to Nebuchadnezzar's intention of returning to deal with the situation once his army was re-equipped. So maybe the Edomites were there to communicate on behalf of Nebuchadnezzar. It is possible that the aggression of these Babylonian vassals produced the outcome that we read earlier in Arad 24. This activity was directed upon Judah and could have involved Arad, which is a place. The normal channel for the Edomites to attack would have been the road to Edom. This route passed by the ascent to the wilderness of Judah near Ramoth Negev. So that's in the south. From Negev, again, is that triangular. It's almost it's the road, it's a region on the way to the Sinai Peninsula. So it could have come through Ramoth Negev. The second buffer, which is Arad, was positioned near the convergence of two routes that led from Edom to Jerusalem. This does not seem to have been the siege which produced a different document, but it could easily have been what produced the correspondence I read to you in Arad 24. When the command for attack upon Judah was given by the suzerain, Nebuchadnezzar would speak to his vassals and they would obey. The other groups would pass into Judah by crossing the Jordan River just north of the Dead Sea. Edom would have traveled the route which passed to the western side of the Dead Sea, up towards Jerusalem. And we find there that there are multiple bands happening, attacking Jerusalem at that point. Okay. The final blow came in 598 to 597 BC when the Babylonian forces pierced their buffer zone north of Judah and came on to the Benjamin Plateau. The tribe of Benjamin is north of Jerusalem. Sometime between 604 BC and this event, Jehoiakim had died, probably by assassination, although it's hard to find evidence for it. He's replaced by his son Jehoiachin, and rather than fight Babylon, Jehoiachin surrendered. Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon. He and his mother and his servants, his captains and his officials, they were led away into exile with all Jerusalem, all the captains, all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, all the craftsmen and smiths. None remained except the poorest of the Lord, of the land. Excuse me. So now you have all the leadership gone. Jehoiachin's gone. The armies are gone. The means of producing weapons, craftsmen and smiths, are gone. And so Edom could now swoop down on their defenseless victims with no threat of outside interference, except that of Babylon, who's sort of on their side. Some people would say verses 11 through 13 happen after you have the three-stage invasion, right? You have the Babylonian invasion, the 605, first wave, 597, second wave, 586, last wave of taking Jerusalem finally captive. And the Edomites could have come in after that and said, we're going to really finish them off. That's one view. I know all that explanation just to get to that one view. That's why some would say 586. Because in verses 11 through 13 of Obadiah, you stood aloof while they were raided and Jerusalem was raided. And so that's one view of what happened. That's probably the most popular view of what has happened with historically behind Obadiah. But there's another view I want to talk about just to give you food for thought and so you'd be aware of it. A second view you see on your sheet under letter D, view 2, would be 853 to 841 during the reign of King Jehoram. This time would make Obadiah a contemporary of two famous prophets named Elijah and Elisha. Okay. Why would we potentially choose this time? Because there were three other significant invasions of Jerusalem in Old Testament history. Around 925, Shishak, the king of Egypt, during Rehoboam's reign, invaded Jerusalem. In the next century, 848 to 841, the Philistines and Arabians during Jehoram, you can spell that better than I did there, Jehoram's reign, invaded Jerusalem. And then the next century, 50 years later, Jehoash, king of Israel, came against Jerusalem as well. The only dates that fit well are the 848 to 40 date and the one we already talked about, 586. Only those really fit the written history well. Some, you would say, well, why with all of this description in Obadiah of Jerusalem being razed and being violated, why would you even consider any other date? Well, here's why. It's worth consideration. Does Obadiah mention the total destruction of the city? Nope. It doesn't. Does Obadiah mention the temple being razed or destroyed? No, he doesn't. Does Obadiah mention the Babylonians by name? Nope, he doesn't. Every other prophet does mention the Babylonians by name when describing the Babylonian invasion. Does Obadiah mention the destruction of the temple or the deportation of the people? Not exactly. And the captives here appear to be taken southwest, not east of Babylon. So don't shoot bad arrows at somebody that dates it early. And don't give a hard time to somebody that dates it around 586 either. Okay? There's good reason to think of that supports either one. Now, if you're in support of the later date, you could say, you know what? Obadiah's focus is not the Babylonians. Doesn't have to talk about them. It's the Edomites. And the rest is background from other prophecies. Okay, that's fine. But there are two dates, and I know I took a long time for you to hear about that. But we're going to walk through a lot of dates, and it's just important to note it is challenging to figure these. How do we draw a conclusion? One question is, who is borrowing from whom? Is Obadiah borrowing from Joel? What about Jeremiah? Who's borrowing from whom? And if so, why? Now, the simplest solution is to say, nobody's borrowing from anybody. God says the same thing more than once. And that certainly does happen. That's not a problem. But it's very possible one is borrowing from the other. Joel does write, as the Lord has said in chapter 3, verse 8, so he may be doing the quoting of Obadiah. One other possibility, and there's other possibilities. One possibility is that perhaps the Lord spoke through Obadiah about something that happened long before But the consequences of that kind of action will be repeated and fulfilled dramatically after the Edomites do it again. It's possible. Okay? It could have had an historic referent, but then something like it happened again later. Okay? That is very possible that it worked that way. But we're not going to know for sure until we get to heaven or until someone finds another document in their dirt that says, here's what the Edomites did. We don't have to know. We do have to know whose day it is. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar thought it was his day of victory, his day of conquest. The day of the Lord is coming. The Edomites may have thought, hey, this is our day. We finally decimated our patriarch's pesky brother, Jacob. The Lord says, no, the day of the Lord is still coming. It's not your day. Ultimately, well, the author, we believe, we're convinced, is Obadiah. The text states that. And there's a lot happening on here. Maybe just to preview some of the historical and theological themes happening here. Well, let me just ask you some questions. What are some principles you would see, just having heard what you heard tonight about Obadiah, what are some principles or issues that God has with the Edomites in this portion? Al? Okay. Vengeance belongs to the Lord. So if the Edomites had a problem with the Israelites, they should have pursued the Lord. They didn't in general anyway. Okay, sure. Okay. Was there any reason to think that the Hebrew people should have special protection or favor from anyone?
Well, God promised them special protection.
Okay.
But He oftentimes lifts that because they don't follow Him.
That's exactly right. God promised special protection. He often removes that when there's disobedience of His people. To whom did God make this promise? You know this. I heard it. Abraham, the Abrahamic covenant, God says, I will bless you and make your name great. And those that bless you, I'm going to bless. Those that curse you, I'm going to curse. Foolish decision, Edomites, to try to curse or harm someone that God protects. Really dumb. Really, really dumb. And so we have reasons to be frustrated with our national leadership at time. Ron?
I was going to ask, was there a particular incident that caused this judgment to come upon you? Like, was there a battle, a war, or resurrection or something?
That's exactly what I'm trying to make clear, that we don't know for sure whether the Edomites were opportunists after Jerusalem was ransacked in 586 B.C., or if they were opportunistic, and we know they messed with Jerusalem around 840 to 850 B.C. There are historical events for both. And the Edomites' role of the second is more presumed, and it's documented more for the older date. So it's difficult because what happens when the Edomites are not described as having come in later matches the later data. But we know they were involved in the earlier date, though there's not much description except they were involved. So that makes it sort of a toss-up in some sense. In my mind, I simply look at it and say, I know God judged the Edomites every time they opposed His people. Now So the covenant principle is huge. If God promises to bless somebody, we should not go out and try to smack them down, right? That happens sometimes even in big ministries or small ones. You know, here's two guys doing what they're supposed to do, or five, and they compete against one another and try to make the other look bad. That's stupid. I shouldn't use the word stupid. My dad said don't do that. That's foolish, okay? That's a biblical word. It's foolish to do that. honor those whom God is blessing. Love them. Help them. There was the law of the ancient Near East, or the law of the desert. And that meant if you have someone comes to your place for refuge, what do? You don't say, what tribe are you from? What nation are you from? You help them. They become like one of yours, and that builds friendship. And that was a law of the ancient Near East that's still practiced today. You might show hospitality to people who are totally at war with your leaders. That's the way it worked. Of course, sometimes it worked against the pagans, such as Jael's case with Sisera and his army. But anyway, that's an exception to the rule. What about, are there any great commandments, and I'm giving it away practically, that deal with brothers treating one another, how they treat one another? Okay, Darlene, help me. The second great commandment says, love your neighbor as yourself. That came out of Leviticus, by the way. Supposedly dry Leviticus. It's out of Leviticus. God said, treat your neighbors well. Now, if they oppose me, they oppose your welfare, you have to do something. But the Edomites were being opportunists. They were taking advantage of Judah while they were down. They were kicking them and making it worse. So Obadiah, what God said through Obadiah has a lot for us to keep in mind too. You know, there's a proverb that says, do not rejoice at your enemy's calamity, lest God take his gaze off him and turn it to you. Yeah, that's important. So Obadiah humbles us as God fears as well and keeps us where we ought to be. So that's an overview to Obadiah. Next week, God willing, we'll get far through Obadiah, at least halfway through it. Mark? Okay, that's a really important question. The question has to do with, is basically, do God's people, the Israelites, not us as a church, it's not that way, but did God's people as the Israelites have the right really to attack anybody? If you're supposed to love your neighbors yourself, does that mean everybody, you know, Balaam, you know, and all these other, Al's got an input before I get there. That's exactly right. God instructed the Israelites in most cases to go conquer those who are idolatrous and refuse to honor the God of heaven. Okay. So he instructed them in most of those cases, go now or don't go. Wait until I send you. Okay. But God had warned them, too, about not being opportunistic as well. Going only at God's direction. In this case, the Edomites were acting against the people God was blessing. And yet God says later, we know to the Babylonians and Assyrians, I'm going to use your warped sense of power to judge my people. And once you're done, guess what? I'm going to smack you too. Wow. Amazing. So that's sort of a big picture what God says through the prophets. And Edomites should not have been a pagan nation. They could have enjoyed more favor from God's people, but they didn't choose to. There were some exceptions to that, I'm sure. So keep that in mind, too. We can be exceptions to evil rules and evil patterns. And I think I should stop there before I give away the whole prophecy. Anything else you want to observe before we go to our times of prayer? Yes, Paul.
One thing I'm wondering about, I mean, okay, it's not that they're the bad guys, but they're going to be that's going to be looked down on instead of looked up to. Is that more because it's a satanic thing rather than something God endorses? I mean, it's in Scripture that it says it that way, that to help Israel is going to be a curse instead of a blessing at a certain time. And is God just stating the facts?
I think I need you to help me find the passage so I can think about how to answer that one. Because I'm not remembering it, but I don't doubt that there's something.
I know that I've heard it, that at a certain time, those who try helping Israel are actually going to be put down for it instead of lifted up by it. I'm not sure whether it says God is doing that or not. It's probably the satanic force.
Wow. Does anybody else remember that off the top? Pardon?
I don't think that's in the Scripture.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe a misunderstanding of a passage you're remembering.
Okay, that could be.
So I'm going to go to a smarter authority than me and ask Pastor Tim if he remembers anything like that. But and I bet there's something, there's some tweaking on how that passage is handled. To help Israel as a brings judgment.
I don't guess it actually says that it's a curse, but that the people who are helping Israel are actually, they're not supported in that. They're put down in that for some reason. I don't think it's God that's doing that.
Oh, okay. Well, there are many times when other nations look down on it, but for God to not favor people helping Israel, I don't remember that. But there may be, I'm sure there's at least one that says when the other nations do, the other nations will not favor those nations. So let's make that a homework question for me. And we'll move to our prayer time. But that is a good one. And if you all figure it out first, call me. Okay, just call me real fast. It'll be fine. Let's pray and then we'll dismiss our small groups. Father, thank you so much. You haven't left us to wander around in our own futility and our own selfishness and greed, but you have spoken through your prophets what is true and what is good and what corrects our hearts. Oh, please keep doing that, correcting our hearts through what is already written in your word. Oh, God, may we learn from what you've said to others and be different kinds of people characterized by you. In Jesus' name I come. Amen.